प्राणाशरीरं गृहं पूजाते विषयोपभोगरचना निद्रा समाधिस्थितिः संचारपदयोः प्रदक्षिणविधि स्तोत्राणि सर्वाग्यरो यद्यत् कर्म करोमि तत्तदखिलं शुम्भो तवारा. O Lord, may we feel that thou art the soul of our souls, that it is thine energy which is functioning as our mind and intelligence. May our bodies be thine abode, and all our enjoyments be as offerings unto thee. May our powers and desires be the companions of thy will, and our lives the instruments of thy purpose. May our every word be a hymn unto thee, our every act thine adoration, our every step a pilgrimage to thy shrine. And may we realize, O Lord, that all we see is lighted by thy light, that the universe and all its beings are thy very self. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavid Vishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being
look over us lovingly as Mother and Father.
May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill
to study together the art of spirituality.
May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om peace, peace, peace be unto us all. Good morning and welcome to the second installment of Spirituality and the Artist. I think a number of you were here on an earlier occasion when I spoke on this subject. It was quite a long time ago. And so I feel that I will have to recap what was said on that Sunday to a certain extent, remind you, at least in outline, of what we talked about on the previous Sunday. And the first thing, of course, I have to say is that by artist we mean, please understand by artist in this talk, I can only use one word at a time, we mean those who are involved in any kind of creative production for the benefit of others. A musician, a speaker, a composer, a poet. We mean the arts, the letters, and all creative activity, as well as the graphic artist, or the modeler, or sculptor, whatever. All the arts. And please understand that they're inclusive when I talk about them that way. And the second thing that I have to say, of course, is, as I said it before in the previous installment, I am not an artist, and yet I am an artist because I have to compose speeches, and also because I was deeply into music in my pre-monastic life. I do know the discipline of music, and so I use that a great deal in my comments and my thinking about this subject. I think it's an invidious... first let me say, I should say, that we said on the in the previous occasion, we quoted Sri Ramakrishna to the effect that if any person excels in any particular craft or art, in any particular talent, that person has a good chance of being a spiritual aspirant. You might wonder why, and I think it's good to keep that positive declaration in mind before we even begin this discussion, because he's put it in a very positive way. If anyone who has developed or is born with or has developed a special skill or talent which is extraordinary in the field of human work, that person has a better chance than the ordinary one of becoming a successful spiritual aspirant. Now, that's on two counts, I said, quoting last time, I said this for two reasons. One is that person has had a number of practicing sessions in his life. Person must have practiced a great deal to have perfected that kind of talent. And it's concentration and practice that makes for the development of spiritual life, of course, but the concentration and development of talent, which is accomplished in the development of an artist, is also the same thing which can be applied in spiritual life, and very properly so. And what is the other account? The other account is such people have already developed a sense of self-worth. They have come upon or developed a sense of their own intrinsic worth. And that's one of the things that in Vedanta we consider very important in spiritual life. We don't say, I'm a sinner, I'm a worm, and so on. We say we are children of God, if not parts of God, if not God himself, in essence. So, on these two scores, the artist has a head start towards spiritual life. Now, the first question that I raised last time was, are not the artist and the spiritual aspirant temperamentally incompatible? Isn't the artistic temperament and the spiritual inclination a matter of internal struggle and incompatibility? Well, if you believe that Shankaracharya wrote the hymns that he is supposed to have written to the gods and goddesses, they're beautiful hymns, he was not only a tremendous renunciate and probably the greatest of all monks and teachers of renunciation and highest attainment, Advaita, in the world, and yet he was able, if it was the same person, some of us doubt whether it was the same person, but if it was the same person, then he wrote all these wonderful hymns to the various devotional schools, and was a poet of the first order. Why would we raise this question? I asked it last time. Why would we raise the question of the temperamental incompatibility for a spiritual aspirant? Well, the question comes down to this. Isn't art likely to consume you? If you are practicing an art and you are putting your whole being into it and you are intent upon it and earnest about it, is there not a chance that this will distract and completely eat you up so that you will not be able to do spiritual life? Well, there are people who can avoid that, and there are people who have avoided it. I will be going on to explain that a little bit later. But that was one of the questions that was raised. I think it's probably a lot more spiritual to have an avocation in art than to have it in managing Enron and other kinds of businesses. Business procedures that take up a whole part of our life, can be carried on along with spiritual life, and I think that's even more difficult. So, we'll put that to rest. And then we talked about the idea that to be creative was considered sinful. This was true for ages and ages in the Western world. The Roman Church just criticized any development of originality, any suspicion of creativity that might get out of bounds, and the only kind of creativity that was allowed was that was which was in the scope of the doctrines and dogmas of the Church, and even then not much. It was all frowned on. So for a long time, large sections of Western culture have considered artistic creativity to be sinful, or at least to be dangerous, say the least, be dangerous. And the Inquisition was instituted to punish people who had been unduly creative. Mm-hmm. That's it. And then we talked about many non-artists seeing the artists as bohemian, eccentric, out on the edges of society, and so on, peculiar. And I pointed out at that time that if that is so, if there's an inevitable connection between being an artist and being eccentric, then what about all the Oriental artists? This is a Western idea I'm going to develop later on, but it is a very, very Western cultured idea that there must be some such kind of eccentricity and idiosyncrasy. And if we look to the artists of China, artists of Japan, artists of India, almost the whole Oriental from Mideast on out to the East, you find artists have not had that kind of reputation. It hasn't been understood that for one to be a great artist, one had to be eccentric and egoistic, egotistic. So that puts the lie to that. And then we talked about discipline last time. How many long hours of practice the artist has to engage in with the brush, or with the voice, or with the instrument, or in whatever way. Those who have developed talents have done it always through long hours of practice. They're not talking about the occasional genius who is born, Mendelssohn's born a genius at the piano and so on. They're not talking about those people. Those are very rare. But most of the artists in the world have had to practice long hours and discipline their lives, at least with respect to their talent, for a long time before being recognized and successful. The point was, and I said it last time, if that discipline can be carried into the whole of our life, if our everyday's activities can be made as important to us, as careful, as determined and deliberate as the activities that are carried on in the pursuit of an art, then, you see, we have a totally new purchase on life. If the artist, whoever he or she may be, in whatever field, can take that same application ability and put it into the entire life, his relations with other people, is he as careful to relate properly to other people as he is to make this brush stroke or this line in the poem? Then there would be spirituality, it would be artistry plus spirituality. Or rather, better the other way around. There would be spirituality plus art. And that's what we were aiming for. Then I raised another question last time. There's a lot of talk about spontaneity in the world of art, in the world of performance particularly. And yes, in the world of art, all kinds of art. What about spontaneity? It's considered a prime value by many, many artistry. We mustn't crimp spontaneity. Spontaneous is the word for it when we feel the urge to create and we cannot miss the opportunities to be spontaneous. And if you put too much discipline into life, won't it kill the spontaneity of the artistic venture, artistic mood? Well, I have to say about this that there is an art, a very important art, called improvisation. And having been at times an amateur organist, I know in the field of organ how important it is to be able to improvise. The great organists of this world, and you can hear their program every Sunday night, all the great organists of this world are called upon from time to time to improvise. Somebody gives them a little theme, a little melody, and they are asked to build upon this a rhapsody, some short kind of theme and variations of that sort. They take it up and they expound and expand this theme and weave it into a tremendous fabric. The theme, you can't wonder where the theme went. You can't find it anymore. It's gone. Practically lost. But the music is all built on the foundation of that one little theme, and it rises and it rises and it convolutes and it goes round and round. And those who are experienced in that art, they understand what the organist is doing. And this is spontaneity based on discipline. Spontaneity, which has the whole background of years and years of playing organ pieces before one attempts to be an innovator. Improvisation has structure. Improvisation has detail and practice and dedicated study behind it. That kind of spontaneity I would accept, and we talked about that last time. Well, the artist has to have vision, we said. He has to have vision. He mustn't be bound to a limited horizon, prostituting his art to some kind of business proposition or to some organization or church or somebody that holds down his capacity to conceive. And that happens to a lot of artists. In order to make a living, in order to survive in the world of art, they sell their souls to the whatever, to the business world. And you've seen that all the time on television and in commercials of every kind. People with real talent sometimes get drawn into commercialism, which prostitutes their talent, and that's a very sad thing. We have seen in our study of the Upanishads of late how all of the aspects of existence, remember in the Upanishad, sages of the Upanishad, all the aspects of existence culminate in the ananda, the joy, sukha. And out of that joy comes all creation. We saw creation itself traced back to the primeval joy, the primeval happiness, which is the acme of experience. And that joy becomes a fountain For the artist, the joy of experiencing God in reality and truth becomes a fountain from which all of this creative activity, poetry, arts, literature, culture itself is the result of the joy of our contact with the divine. We may not recognize that, we may not know that that's what it is, but that is what it is. It all comes out from that fountain we call Ananda. Swami Vivekananda says there is not a moment in this world, not a moment in which we are not experiencing that Ananda, but we do not recognize it. And then we talked about greatness versus fame. You remember. Greatness and fame are not synonymous. And some of the most famous artists, writers, poets, singers, musicians, composers, and so on, are not necessarily great. I think of St. Francis. I don't suppose you even know that he was not only a poet, but also an artist, a painter. He was good in all of the fields which were called arts in those days. Music, he sang. He was a great saint, but he was also a great artist because he concealed that the individuality of his art. He concealed that which would have made him famous as an artist. Fra Angelico, the painter of murals of that time, was another spiritual artist. There had been many spiritual artists in India, many, many spiritual poets, musicians, composers, sculptors that you don't even know, we don't even know about. And I think this question was the last one on that session. For spiritual aspirants, won't artistic activity be a big distraction? I raised that question a little bit before or today, but going into it more deeply now, will not the practice of art distract us as spiritual aspirants from the primary purpose, which is to practice spiritual life, to do sadhana? And my answer, you remember, I hope you remember, my answer was, I'm giving it briefly now, it was in detail. It depends upon the stage of our life. For instance, let me take up monastic life as an example of intense spiritual activity. I don't mean that intense spiritual activity has to be limited to monastic life, it doesn't. But if you take up monastic life, which I know more about than any other, in the early stages, it may be necessary for a person of artistic talent to soft pedal that creativity. Because there's so much to learn. There's so much to learn in the beginning about meditation, about the scriptures, about the history of spiritual life and the history of spiritual personalities and everything that goes into a monk's training is intensive, and it demands full attention and concentration on the business. At a later stage, when that has all been absorbed, when that has been absorbed to a large extent, and one is practiced in meditation and practiced and has a certain number of scriptures under their belt, again, the taking up of the talent is possible and can be carried on, executed with considerable success, along with the development of spiritual life. You see these pictures. I gave you this example last time. This man is the senior monk in our Trabuco monastery, the man who painted all these pictures. These are reproductions of his paintings. And they are excellent, and they're expert, and they're sold all over the world. And they're recognized as being among the most faithful and beautiful of the pictures of our people, people of our movement. That man is now in his 70s, early 70s, but he has continually gone to the shrine room 3 times a day to meditate. Some of you have met him. If you're with us that long, he dedicated this shrine in the other house. And he has been here. And he is a monk in every sense of the word and one of our most admirable monks. And yet he carried on this craft, this art, throughout the whole of his monastic life. So, you see, there are others that I can mention, but I'm trying to summarize this in a hurry. So, why can't art, music, singing, painting, sculpture, whatever, can be considered a karma yoga? Why not make whatever talent you have a karma yoga? I dedicate all of this to my ishtam, or my whatever that I have, is a form of God, and I do this as sadhana. I'm doing this work as sadhana. You know, this because it happens in artistic life that there are periods of depression. It can happen. There come periods of depression when the creator feels that he has lost his creative power, that that somehow the force is not flowing, the juice isn't coming, the talent has faded, or the age has come, and there is a desperate kind of a despair that comes over people who want to be productive in the field of the arts. And you know, I see some of them making confessions like this. If it weren't for my wife, I could never have made it. And books are written dedicated to their wives. You know, I dedicate this book to my wife. It's not for nothing. No, there's a good reason why so many books are dedicated to the wife. Because without that help, without that support, without that food, without so many taking care of the children, lopsided life given to the artist. So when it comes out of monastic life and comes back into householder life, this I have to say about that life, which I know not much about, but the artist, whoever he is, whoever she is, whatever she does, has to make the family, put the family in balance, spiritually in balance, so that no one is taken advantage of, no one is unduly burdened by the craft or art of the partner. And the children. Children cannot be neglected. So it's a balance. Well, I've told you about this Swami. There is another Swami who has passed away now. Lived to be into his 90s. He has painted the most beautiful picture of Sri Ramakrishna, Holy Mother, and Swamiji. And that is in our Uttakamund, Uti ashram in India. And he was a great Swami in many ways, but art was just a byline with him, just a hobby, and yet it turned out beautifully. And we have brahmacharis who are composing. Brahmacharis who are composing hymns and the music for the services, who play the piano and the guitar and so on. They are doing those things as part of their spiritual life. So they're not incompatible. Well, this summarizes the last, the first installment of the talk. Now we go on to the new material. All of that you're supposed to have known already. That was in the last one. So we continue the subject. If you look at the ancient tradition in India, you will find that the actors for plays always prepared their performance with prayer. Actors were not expected to come to any performance without having prepared their minds and hearts through prayer or worship. Of course, you could say, well, all those plays were spiritual. Yes, most of the plays of India are spiritual, even those which are secular, like Shakuntala and the other Kavya plays of Indian culture, have their religious undertone. There is some religious theme, some very important religious theme, spiritual theme, in all of those plays. Very few are purely secular, and if they were, they were neglected. So, yes, the playwrights wrote spiritual plays, so the actors would come and prepare themselves for the performance through proper mental recollection and prayer. And you know Girish Ghosh, the Bengali, father of Bengali drama, it's called, in the time of Sri Ramakrishna. Girish Ghosh, after he had become, he didn't at the beginning, he was a modern, 19th century modern dramatist, composer, dramatic dramatist and actor. And he staged many plays, and some of them in the early period of his composition were not spiritual plays. But after he met Sri Ramakrishna, Girish Ghosh asked all of his principal actors and actresses to come and meet Thakur, meet Sri Ramakrishna, and bow down to him. And when they went back to the stage, back to the theater, pictures of Sri Ramakrishna, as soon as they were available, were put up in all the green rooms, in all of the rooms of the theater where the actors and actresses prepared themselves. And they were asked to bow down to him before they went on stage. So just as one offers a flower or a bowl of flowers at the shrine, just as one offers a fruit or a fruit or basket of fruits or some common object for in devotional life, so why not here in artistic life too? Why not take one's composition, one's song, one's sculpture, one's latest creation, poem, whatever, and lay it before the shrine, saying, Lord, I know where this came from. It didn't come from little me. It came from a much deeper source than I am at present. And it goes to you in the external world, in the infinite. It goes out to you in the infinite. So that's one feature we need to think about. In that day and in that country and those cultures, China, Japan, too, all of this applies to the Far East, art was a ritual. It was a ritual of the society. It was a ritual indigenous to and part and parcel of the culture of the society. It wasn't thinkable that you would begin a creative endeavor on a big project without first bowing to Ganesha in India without first worshipping the ancestors in China. And in the Chinese culture, actually, the painting of a picture, a scroll, or something like that, would have to be considered as a part of the family ritual. The whole family would get together and sit with the artist before he painted, in order to sanctify and to ritualize and bring into the bosom of the family the act which was going to be undertaken. So it became part of religion. Whatever the religion, of whatever religion of that country or that area, this art execution was a part of the religious ritual. So we ought, in practicing the arts, one ought to tie one's talent to one's chosen ideal. We call it the ishta, or the chosen ideal. I mentioned that before. If one believes in a personal God, then what one offers, what one undertakes, should be offered at the feet of the chosen ideal, the ishtam. If one doesn't believe in personal God, there is Brahman, the eternal being, the ultimate being, the broadest possible conception of being, is still a universal existent, something which pervades everywhere, all-pervading and ever-existent. And there are people who feel that that is their highest deity, conception of deity. It can be offered to Brahman. We do that when we eat our food. We're really offering this food, the puja and so on, we're offering it to Brahman. That's the old Brahmarpanam. So, in the think of the Sistine Chapel. I mentioned this last time too. When you go into that Sistine Chapel in Rome and you see those marvelous figures, the colors, the extraordinary scenes and episodes from Christ's life are depicted all around the walls of the chapel. You know, they were made by many artists, different artists were doing. It wasn't all Michelangelo. There were a number of artists that executed those paintings. The ceiling of the Sistine Chapel was done by Michelangelo and painted. And recently, I mean, a few years back, it was all cleaned by modern chemical methods of cleaning. And the colors, the original colors that Michelangelo used were visible there. They were so much brighter. They were so much more alive than what had shown through the veneer. You know, it had been the shellacked or whatever. People had tried to preserve them and covered them with things. They took all that off, and here were the original colors of Michelangelo. And they were so bright and beautiful. And, oh, by the way, there was recently an article, an item on the news that somebody has written a book to show that he didn't paint it lying on his back. It's always been assumed that there was a platform he made there and that he and his helper painted that lying on their backs with the brush like this. And this man has written the book saying, nonsense. He would have had sufficient skill to construct a scaffolding which would allow him to paint it in the ordinary way with over your head with a brush. I'm rather relieved to think of that, because working on your back is a very great strain. Anyway, Michelangelo did that ceiling. And when you see that, you cannot help, when you sit there, and I've just once been there, when you sit there and you take it in visually, your whole being reverberates to it. I found that my whole being, aesthetic nature, was stimulated by that, not just visual. It was as if I could hear the air of that creation, the time. I could hear the sounds in the church. It was as if I could breathe the air that was there at the time of his composition. I felt it throughout my whole being. I had the same feeling in India when I went to Mahabalipuram. Mahabalipuram in the south, those of you who have been to Chennai and the neighboring areas, you see these sculptures, such vivid, such live creations in stone. Is it stone? I think it's all stone. These deities just come to life, and you can see how they get stories around them and legends and followers, people devoted to them. Why? Because those things are alive. They've been created by people whose minds were absolutely concentrated, who were dedicated, who had purified themselves of egoistic impulse. They must have to be able to create that kind of thing. So, the next question. Isn't the artist's lifestyle and the companions he's likely to cultivate incompatible with spirituality? Isn't the artist's lifestyle and his companions, aren't those factors which are incompatible with the development of a spiritual life? This is a legitimate doubt that does arise and makes us sometimes think that the lifestyle of a practicing professional artist, I'm here talking about professionals, not about amateurs like us. If any professionals are here. But anyway, I'm talking about professionals. Isn't that lifestyle conducive to eccentricity? And eccentricity is not desirable in spiritual life. Well, I am here today. Well, I'm here today to prick that soap bubble. That's a soap bubble. It's a chimera. It's absolutely, not say absolutely untrue. There's too much weight given to it. There is too little truth in it. And I am determined to puncture that bubble today. You know, this is mostly a pose. It's a pose that professional people take. They make themselves, in a way, into eccentrics. Society has come in the West to expect eccentricity from the artist. And expecting that eccentricity, the media stimulates that expectation. The media try to create image. Yes, a statement and an image for the artist which will distinguish him and her or her and make that artist important and prominent because of eccentricities. I have seen it happen over and over again. People who start as young people with just pure, plain talent, and by the media and by the society, they are pushed and formed into stars which are expected to be playing some very special part. And after being stimulated by the media, the artist feels that he has to play up to that gallery. That it's a gallery he has to play to. He has to perform in a peculiar way. He has to speak in a peculiar way. He has to take up habits which are peculiar, cultivate friends and companions which are of that nature, and then he becomes an extraordinary and eccentric person. It's the same in sports. Let's move from arts to sports. And you know very well, to what an extent sports have been spoiled in our time. When I was a boy, we had competition, which was unenhanced by drugs. We had competition which was expected to be judged fairly by the referee. Referees weren't bribed in those days. All of this kind of corruption, our Western society has brought in to the performance of sports, and eccentricity is one of those elements which has been introduced. All you have to do is to look at what kind of a person John McEnroe was before he went to Wimbledon, and when in the beginning of his career, he was a nice boy. His family brought him up well. Gets to Wimbledon and misbehaves like the worst, puts on a good show of misbehavior because that brings him fame, that brings him acknowledgement, that brings him media attention, and so on. So, this is a hoax. If you want to argue with me when it's over, you can do that. But people want the spice in sports of bad language, ill temper, balls thrown at people, and swear words and all kinds of things put out that have to be blanked out by the radio. It's our Western psyche. The Western psyche has done this to us. It's our psychic inheritance to accept the peculiar and the unusual and the bizarre as fashionable. This has become the fashion. And it does go against spiritual life. The artistic temperament is not a charter for idiocy, as one has artistic temperament, to claim a necessity for idiosyncrasy. Creative energy's origin. Think about it. The origin of creative energy lies deep, deep within our being. It comes from a divine source, from something so deep within us that we can hardly put our finger on it, define it, and we do not find it. For many years we don't find that source sometimes. That source is found at the end of spiritual sadhana. Even without spiritual sadhana, those who have creative talent can recognize that what they are bringing forth is not from the ego, not from the surface life, not from the individual's smallness, but is a flow of energy coming from a deep, deep source and going out to a vast infinity of recipients. So what the spiritual artist has to do is to understand where that originality comes from. The originality is not the creation of his own petty mind or his own individual endeavors at developing a talent. He is merely the vehicle of expression. Ananda Kumaraswamy was a great artist. Ananda Kumaraswamy was a great writer. And he knew, he was a sophisticate, one of the most sophisticated people of the 19th century. You can read his books on Shiva and on art, and you will be amazed at his mind. This is what he said. The peculiarity or distinctiveness of an artist's style comes from the accidents of his life, not from the essence. Let me repeat it. The peculiarity, the distinctiveness of any artist's style comes from the mere accidents of his or her life, not from its essence. The essence of an artist's life is part of that flow of energy which starts in the divine, in Brahman, and comes through the individual and goes out to the world at large, the audience. It comes from there and goes to the audience. That's where it comes. That's the essence of it. So, the artist is not expressing himself. He said, this is the big mistake, the big lie, the great lie that the artist is told, express yourself. Anybody of any kind of creative talent is told by the psychologist, express yourself, don't suppress, express yourself. And here is Kumaraswamy telling us, the artist does not express himself, he expresses that which was to be expressed. Think about that. That which was to be expressed has been expressed by the artist. It's not himself. It's that which lies far behind him, brought him into being, and will continue after him, and goes out to the world at large. So, I love this expression. He expresses that which was to be expressed. That's a Zen saying. That's a Zen saying. You could take it right out of a Zen book. Yes, self-expression, yes, but which self? We have many selves. We have many selves, you know? And nobody cares very much to have you express your little self. In fact, you'll get scolded for it most of the time. Expressing our little selves and expressing our real self with the capital S, all the difference in the world. Kumaraswamy says, the artist needs to forget history. Now I stopped at that. I paused and I said, what do you mean? What does he mean? How can the musician not study the history of music? How can the artist not study the history of art? A painting. Oh, what do you think it means? I think it means that if one wants to be an original, and most great artists want to be original, if one wants to be original, one has to turn one's back to tradition. Too much of study of tradition is dampening to artistic talents. And if you follow the conventions too much, if you are too imbued with the spirit of what's gone before and has been done this way all the time, you will not be able to awaken the spring of your creativity. I think of the music of Charles Ives. I love the music of Charles Ives because it's so fresh. It is different from all the other symphonic music that went before it. It was totally outre. It was totally outside the limits for many, many decades. And only recently it has come into popularity. Because he ignored history of music and began to start afresh with his own formula. Impressionism. Impressionism could never have occurred. The French school of Impressionism and all those great paintings of Corot and so on would never have, Renoir, they would never have been done if there had been too much attention to the history. Well, Western culture always asks, who? Who painted this picture? Who composed this piece of music? And I do it all the time. I listen to music on the radio. Not a piece comes up from what I don't have this Western habit ingrained in me from childhood. Who wrote that? Who wrote that? Who's playing? Who's performing this? Who? By whom? All the time. Who's? You know, in India, people don't put their names on these things. You paint a great, until modern times, painters didn't put their names on these artistic things. Nobody put their name on the silk portrayal of Krishna and the gopis we had in the shrine. No, I don't think there's a name on it. These things were not named. It didn't matter who produced, what individual it came from. The important thing was, what did it depict? What did it depict? And how great and how beautifully can I depict it? My name is not important. Kumaraswamy, no, not Kumaraswamy, somebody else likens it to a midwife. The artist has to be a midwife because truth is ultimately impersonal. Truth is ultimately impersonal. Now those musicians who have composed works that are not well known, you know, there is a whole treasure. There are treasure troves of compositions that nobody plays, nobody has heard, nobody knows of. Why? Because those people didn't try to become famous. Or if they did, they didn't succeed because of somebody squeezing them out. So, wouldn't it be funny if a midwife felt that she had a little brand here, every baby that comes out, put her name on it. Wouldn't that be funny if every midwife had to brand babies, this one was born by so-and-so. Well, so Kumaraswamy is telling us that truth is ultimately impersonal, and we are only instruments. There's the story of Padmapada. You know, Padmapada was one of Shankaracharya's disciples, one of his four principal disciples. And Padmapada was a poet, and Padmapada composed a long poem to Shiva called the Shiva Mahimna Stotram, hymn to the greatness of Shiva. And he was very proud. Unfortunately, though a very highly spiritual monk, he had that pride, the pride of an artist, the pride of a creator. And with that pride, he went to Shankaracharya and showed him his poem. And Shankara said, why don't you take that poem into the temple and show it to Shiva, and he offer it to Lord Shiva. And he went in, and when he got into the temple, he found Nandi. Shiva has a bull called Nandi, and that Nandi always sits in front of Lord Shiva in the temple, big temple. So he went and approached Lord Shiva, and there was Nandi with his mouth wide open, and on every tooth, of every one of Nandi's tooth, he saw a verse of his poem already written there. Verse of his poem. And Shiva, then he didn't even have to talk to Shiva. He understood. He was smart enough, spiritual enough to understand. All he had done was to discover the poem. The poem had already been written in the mind of eternity, and he had simply lifted the lid. Now, get that concept, you see? everything, if everything that we discover could be understood as something which was already there, but we just took the lid off and there it was. And we thought it was ours. I wrote this poem. You're back from Nandi quite humbled. Good story, anyway. And so, this brings up the idea of freedom. Freedom stimulates creativity, but not the kind of freedom that I found on a tape the other day when I played it. Somebody sat down at a piano and let his fingers wander around and doodled at the piano and called it music in the night or music for outer space or something like that. And it was just rambling on the piano. Anybody who knows anything of music knows that this man is just letting his imagination run free. There was no structure behind it. There was no discipline behind it. That is not the kind of freedom which produces creativity. It is not. So, the prima donna needs to be a prima donna because she is because she is structured, she's disciplined, and reflective. And just take you an example. Maria Callas. She had the most beautiful voice, one of the most beautiful soprano voices that ever was born into this world. But the opera and the media and the commercial interests succeeded in making her into one of the most vindictive and dogmatic and temperamental and irascible people that has ever been on the stage. Isn't that right? Mm-hmm. Compare her with the ones I knew in my time as a child, as a youth: Rosa Ponsell, Kirsten Flagstad, Marian Anderson. These were prima donnas who had the heart and the mind of benefactors, artists who wanted to be benefactors of humanity. Every one of them saw to it that money of theirs was spent on charity and that they had a personal interest in helping people who were climbing the ladder. Every one of them. And they were not the kind of prima donnas that modern society creates. They were true masters or maestros. The true maestro is a master of his moods. Master of our moods we have to be. There was a great cellist named Pablo Casals, probably the greatest cellist of modern times, and he says, it is a myth that there is any supportive, mutual support between genius and insanity. It is a myth that there is any mutual support between genius and insanity. And he was a great genius and a great artist and conductor. So we have to take his word for it. Of course, I'm not saying, finally, that there are no inspired moods that have to be carefully cherished. There are. Spontaneity has its place. There's an importance of capturing a creative mood when it rises. If you're in the middle of meditation, this is a touchy point. If you're in the middle of meditation and you suddenly get inspired to create a song or a poem or a piece of art, should you get up and do that? I don't know. But at least in our ordinary way of life, apart from meditation, we should cultivate and capture the moods of inspiration. I'm not saying that we shouldn't. But they need to be guided. They need to be guided by an inwardness, a yoga. That's what yoga means. Karma is not karma yoga unless there is an inward element to it. And that inwardness, that self-knowledge, the understanding of the source, and, see, Brahman is the source, and I'm giving it to Brahman. Brahman is the object of my talent, and Brahman is the source of my talent. I'm just the intermediary. And if that awareness is there, and high purpose of is there, then it's quite, I think, permissible to drop everything and take up the creative impulse. Now, there are many other aspects of this subject which I haven't gone into today and haven't gone into in the two sessions. Maybe we'll have a third session on that sometime, but there are lots of interesting questions in art and society, art and politics and so on. But I'm ready for your challenges. I'm sure some of you may have something to say back to me.
My father was a doctor, and as you know, he was instituted by Holy, and he was an ardent lover of Indian classical music. So when I was 7 years old, he would go for all whole night performances, and he would take a blanket, comforter with him, because I was too little to sit up whole night. And I would sleep on his hand, and he would cover me up with a comforter, and lift me up and bring me to the car and take me home.
So he was spiritual and also a craftsman, artist. Anybody else? Yes?
There was a couple of things I wanted to say. One was that up until the Renaissance in the West, artists were anonymous. Which I think is instructive.
Yes.
Because the Renaissance was really the birth of the...
ego.
Well, yeah, public. The birth of humanity.
Yes.
And, as we understand
it. Awakening of intelligence.
Right, because at that point, art, painting, sculpture, all music was all composed and performed and but even in India, there are exceptions to the anonymity. But by and large, it was anonymous. The other thing I struggle with is your definition of eccentricity versus originality, because I think that what I'm understanding you to say about eccentricity is that it's when you're ego bound, that in whatever way. How I took it that you meant eccentricity, because I know a lot of eccentric people, or what from the outside looks eccentric, you know, that, I mean, it's harmless, you know, they may have their, what I think of as idiosyncrasies, or they may think of as my idiosyncrasies, but it doesn't seem to, that doesn't seem to be what binds them ego-wise, like, because they have five puppies, or I don't know what you meant by eccentricity.
Oh, of course, I really didn't mean eccentricity of personality traits or something unrelated to art. I'm talking about egocentricity, or eccentricity, rather. See, they work together. Egocentricity means living on the edge of the circle. If you are Brahma-centric, you're in the middle of the circle. If you are egocentric, you're on the outside, which is the same as eccentric, off-center.
But how is that different from originality? I mean, you're saying on the one hand to you should learn history, but then shut the door on it so that you can be open to new and creative experiences.
Well, that's how I was interpreting Kumaraswamy in his saying that. That also is a puzzle for me. I think that needs to be thought out a little more. Balance.
Stand
yes.
On the shoulders of our past,
what Casals is saying is that there's no necessary connection between psychosis and talent, or genius and psychosis.
I agree. There's not necessarily, but sometimes they do seem to coincide.
Quite often they do, and I acknowledge that, and that maybe the eccentric person has. Oh, let me put it this way. The eccentric person may have an even better chance of being a spiritual aspirant than most of us.
if they can set that aside.
Because or incorporate it and use it. Some people can incorporate their eccentricity or their abnormality or their whatever. So they can incorporate that into their spiritual path. See?
Yeah, I agree. I think that every, as you were saying, every generation builds on the shoulders of the
other one. Right.
And that's in every culture. That in some ways you have to reject the earlier. And there's a lot going on now that I don't understand, but people younger than me say this is cutting edge.
Sure. That's right.
And I have to believe that they
have something.
They are saying something valid because I said it when I was younger about stuff of my parents and my grandparents' generation.
I acknowledge that. And then this is an old man's lecture this morning. This point of view of a man in the 80s. And that has naturally got that flavor about it. And I accept that amendment that the modern generation may have things to tell me that I don't understand about art.
Swamiji?
Yes.
The hour is very long. I want to say, hopefully we have an open forum. Because if you are discussing science and religion, why shouldn't we discuss art and spirituality also?
Well, I'm afraid of not having enough people.
Only one point I would say, because it kept on coming, that yes, now the neuroscience is making more and more research to find out that the people that we call genius, they had an inherent underlying brain disorder. The one on which it has been done is Samuel Johnson. At one time was thought to be intelligentsia of England, and now they have definitely found the disease that he was suffering from, for which we have got a treatment now. There was no treatment then, and if he was treated, he would not have produced a dictionary.
Okay, then all you doctors are going to remove all the talent in the world by making everybody normal.
Gradually things are coming out. Suppose you put out there is too much of work of one group of brain cells compared to the others, and therefore if you talk this.